And good afternoon. This is KLOI, Lopez Community Radio, and we're here in the studio today. This has been pre-recorded, actually in first part of May, and here we are into June, and we've been visiting with Richard Fagan on this Strange and Wonderful World series that Richard Fagan is actually hosting, and I'm the producer of. I run the machines. I won't go into that, but yes, I do. So, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And I'm looking forward to this. As I say, we're leaving. We've spent the winter in Antarctica appropriately. Helped us appreciate a rather cold winter on Lopez, but nothing like the Antarctic. And we're off to the Pacific. So I'm going to tell us where we're going and what we're going to be doing, Richard.
Well, I thought that we should make a little trip around the world's oceans. In one sense, we've been in one of the world's oceans, or at least got to Antarctica through one of the world's oceans, the South Atlantic. And now we're going to move over to the Pacific, and since the weather's warming up outside, we're going to warm up also. And ever since I was a teenager, I've had a real, almost an obsession about diving, about scuba diving, about free diving. And I thought I'd share some information about that, not really about me, but about this underwater world as an introduction to the Pacific, because we're going to take a tour through quite a few aspects of the Pacific, and of course it's a water world, and it's water which really defines that world, and so we're going to spend some time in the water now. It's been too cold to spend time in the water in Antarctica, although there are people who do that. So now we're going to go to warmer waters. It's about time.
All right. Well, I look forward to some diving. Let's dive in, so to speak.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. First, a little bit of background about what I just called my obsession. In 1951, I had my first opportunity to use scuba gear. It was actually in the Bahamas, and I was just, what was it? I was an 18-year-old puppy, and I just adored. I'd always liked the water, swimming, etc. And I just adored the freedom and the experience that came with using scuba gear. Back at that time, it wasn't very carefully controlled. And at a beachfront, if there was somebody with some gear, they say, hey, for $25, would you like to try this kind of thing? And so I took a few, informal lessons. And enjoyed it very, very much. And then when I was in the service in the mid-50s, I actually did a great deal of free diving, diving without scuba gear, did a lot of spearfishing. We'll talk a little bit about that later. And I also did some professional shallow water diving, because the Army had an engineering unit which used professional gear, but not this hard hat gear that you see in the pictures, but surface applied gear where you just wore a mask and compressed air came down from the surface. And then even later, I worked on the Discovery Channel documentary about the waters around Cuba, and I had an opportunity to go down in a research submarine to close to 2,000 feet and peer out to the little porthole at the dark and very, very strange world that's out there. So except for the little time that I worked professionally after I got out of the Army down in the Caribbean, this has never been a professional field of mine, and I wouldn't claim it in any sense to be a professional, but it's certainly something that I've been interested in for decades and decades. So I thought we should talk about it, because it is a good introduction, really, to the Pacific. And it's also, not this time, I don't think, but probably next time, we'll talk about some of the really strange things that people are doing in order to get themselves deep into the ocean under their own power, so to speak. In other words, without any
air support.
Air support, yeah.
I don't know if I want to hear that, but I'm also intrigued,
yeah,
of course.
Okay. Well, is a kind of very short history of what some people call man in the sea should really be called man and woman in the sea, but it goes back a very long way. We get in Thucydides, the Greek historian, mention of the use of divers in the siege of Syracuse. Already at that time, the Greeks and their enemies knew how to fortify a shore underwater by putting sharpened stakes and things so that boats and ships couldn't be brought close to shore. So just as in subsequent wars all the way down to our time, there were in effect people who were like the Navy SEALs today. They would go in. Of course, they had no breathing apparatus of any kind. They just swim in, and they would try, often successfully, to dismantle these obstacles to coming to shore.
And I assume other people had gone in and placed those obstacles
in
the same way.
Except that it's easier to place them from a boat.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
I see.
But if you're trying to take them out surreptitiously, then you pretty much have to swim in. You can't bring a boat in.
That defeat the purpose there.
Yeah, that's right. exactly. Now, Aristotle, who, as I think most of you know, was fascinated by all kinds of mechanical devices and mechanical issues and things like that, was interested in diving bells, which were already understood at that time.
Hmm.
And this is a quote, obviously a translation from Aristotle, about the diving bells. He says, "They can give respiration to divers by letting down a cauldron, for this does not fill with water but retains its air. Its lowering has to be done by force." So translating this into our experience in the bathtub as children, when you take your pail, turn it upside down, and try and force it below the surface of the water, of course you're trapping air in the pail, and that air makes it come to the surface. But of course, if you apply enough pressure or enough weight on it, you can get it down. And there will be, still inside the pail, air. And if you push it down far enough, the air will be compressed by the water pressure. So that is a diving bell, I mean, in this early configuration. Now, there were also, way back, there were people who just jumped in, often with a rock or something in their hands, and let themselves be carried down to depth. The two most famous, although there were other groups that did this, were the Japanese Amas, as they're called, A-M-A-S, who go back about 1,500 years anywhere. They're always women. They wore no masks, no fins. They would go to as much as 100 dives a day, and they dove both for pearls, obviously for oysters, for the pearls, but also for seafood. And in fact, I'm told, I've never seen it, that as little as a couple decades ago, you could actually go to Japan and you would still see there were amas who were diving in one area. They wore a kind of loose, almost like a sarong type garment. They still didn't use masks and flippers, even though those were easily available at that time. And they just went to these profound depths, you know, 80, 90, even 100 feet in some cases, to get things off the bottom. And it was a traditional occupation.
Right.
Yeah, you had to sort of be born into a village and then trained as a girl and et cetera. Quite amazing. And then in the Pacific Islands themselves outside of Japan, it was the Polynesian pearl divers who were the most famous. Again, the same thing, not using masks, which they didn't have, not using fins or anything on their feet, but just swimming, very often carrying a weight, because we'll get to this later. You don't want, if you have positive buoyancy in seawater, you don't want to expend a lot of energy forcing yourself down. So it's much easier just to take a rock and just relax and let yourself be carried down. Polynesian pearl divers, again, diving to 80, 90, even 100 feet just on breaths of air. Now, let's take a little break here and talk about the physiological aspects of this diving. Most of you probably know something about it, but let's try and systematize it a little bit. Water, of course, is heavy. Anybody who's carried a 5-gallon bucket of water knows how heavy it is. And that water puts pressure on the water below or anything in it. So as soon as you begin to submerge yourself in water, anybody who's gone to the bottom of a swimming pool and felt their ears pain knows this, more pressure is put on you. As a kind of rough rule of thumb, for every 33 feet you go down in seawater, and from this point forward we'll be talking about seawater, a little different than freshwater, but it needn't concern us here, the pressure increases another 15 pounds per square inch. Sitting right here at sea level, and on Lopez we're roughly at sea level, you have about 14.7 or 15 pounds per square inch of air pressure on you. Of course, we don't experience it as that. But what this means is that if you go down 33 feet, you have doubled the pressure on your body. And for every 33 feet that you go down, you add another 15 pounds per square inch. So at 100 feet, roughly, you've added 45 pounds per square inch to whatever is down there. And that's a lot of pressure. I mean, you know, you're probably carrying in your automobile less than 45 pounds per square inch in your tires, and you know how hard it is. I mean, it's supporting a 3,000-pound automobile.
Right, right.
So 45 pounds per square inch is already a lot of pressure, but we'll get to pressures much greater than that. So pressure at depth, increasing rapidly. The other issue about water or going into water is that the heat conductivity is about 20 times that of air, which is why if it's 70 degrees out and you're wandering around and doing a little exercise, basically you feel completely comfortable unless for some reason the wind is blowing a lot. In 70 degrees in the water without any kind of thermal protection, you can get hypothermia, because the heat is carried away from your body so fast by that water that you don't have the capacity to replace it, and then the internal temperature of your body
drops,
and eventually it can kill you, of course. So the third thing that we should be are aware of is that we can't take oxygen from the water, unlike fish. Fish are wonderful. That's what their gills do. They can suck oxygen out of the water. And there are still people who dream, Jacques Cousteau among them when he was alive, that a device could be made which would give us artificial gills. In other words, we wouldn't have to carry oxygen down with us, but that we could get oxygen out of the water just with some small device so that we could breathe underwater, breathe oxygen underwater the way fish do. Needless to say, we don't have that yet. Mm. So, where does that leave us? We either have to bring the air with us, or the oxygen with us, because all that's of interest in the air is the oxygen. We're not interested in the nitrogen. We'll get to that too. Well, we're interested in it, but for different reasons. So we either bring it in our lungs by taking deep breath and then holding it, or we take it in compressed air, or it doesn't have to be compressed air. It can be compressed gases that has oxygen in them, because a lot of diving is now done with compressed gases that have very little nitrogen and mainly oxygen and other gases. Or the third way we can get down there is if we're encapsulated in some kind of non-compressible envelope, which is filled with air. In other words, a submarine, right? Some kind of submarine. And finally, because we're not very well adapted to, you know, living in water, we don't see very well underwater because the index of refraction is different. So there has to be an air pocket between the water and our eyes. It can be a mask. It can be us in the air looking into the aquarium. It can be the viewing port in a submarine. It can be almost anything, but air on the eyeball, not seawater. Anybody who's opened their eyes underwater, and probably most of us have, realize you can see things, but you sure don't see them very clearly.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, all of this leads me to wonder about these traditional cultures that have developed this incredible capacity. I assume it is an increased lung capacity so that they can,
yes.
I mean, and I, you know, that must started infancy years.
We'll talk about this later, but can train yourself. Probably anyone in good health can double very quickly the time they can hold their breath by simple training mechanisms.
In
2 days, mm-hmm. 3 days, something like that.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, fascinating.
By very simple mechanisms. Now, let's go back to man and woman trying to get in the sea. One early, very early, but very important breakthrough was something called Halley's diving bell. This is in 1690. To sort of put a time on that, you know what that means in American history. It's 90 years after Hamlet was written. So it's still a time when Europe is breaking out very clearly of the Middle Ages into the post-Middle Ages, into more modern times. A lot of experimentation going on.
A lot of innovation in all areas, it seems like.
Yeah.
They're creative.
And Halley is the same English scientist of Halley's Comet. It's mm-hmm. the same man. And what he did was he designed a very large wooden bucket. And I am, at the moment, I'm going to get my picture of this large wooden bucket and try and describe it to you. It really looked like a large wooden bucket, and it was big enough for several men to sit in it on a bench well above the bottom of the bucket, and it had big weights attached to the bottom so that when the bucket was lowered, inverted, of course, with the open side down into the water, it would anchor to the bottom, but it would float above the bottom. And since the bottom was open, it meant that the person who was inside, now the water level would rise, of course, inside as the bucket was lower. The person inside could jump out into the surrounding water. The problem was that it is extremely, jump out with a maybe a bucket over his own head with a tube which went to the air that was inside the bucket. So he had an air supply. The problem is that with lung power, you cannot suck air from a very long distance when you're in the water. Anybody, try it sometime. Take 6 feet of garden hose, go to the bottom of a pool, make sure that the other end of the hose is up there in the air, and try and breathe through that hose. You can't do it unless you have the world's most powerful lungs, because the water pressure, even at 6 feet, is preventing you from making a proper sucking motion.
Right.
So unless the air is being pumped down to you in some way, you can't breathe at the bottom of the pool.
Wow.
So this meant that coming out of the diving bell with a hose, trying to breathe the air in the diving bell, limited you to about a 3-foot differential between the level of the water in the diving bell and the level of your head outside. And even then, you were sucking hard.
Yeah. Wow. It was short. So, I mean,
yeah.
Yeah.
So the point is that the diving bell, which could have a glass port or a view, it was great for getting down there and looking around, but it wasn't very great for working down there, because at the most you could do is swim out of the diving bell, do something while you could hold your breath, and then come back in the diving bell. But it was a breakthrough. It wasn't until 1837 that there was a real sort of diving breakthrough, and that was with what we recognize today as a diving suit. You've all seen pictures of these things, and a hard hat. And
1837.
It was a German who lived in England. And this design, you've probably all seen this in documentaries or something. The design basically stayed unchanged for 100 years. It consisted of a canvas suit, rubberized canvas that was waterproof. So it was dry inside, completely dry. Big lead boots so that your feet would stay on the ground, because you did not want your feet to go above your head in this device.
Yeah.
Okay. Your feet would stay on that. A weight belt on you to make sure that you had negative buoyancy. This big and very often beautiful brass and chrome helmet that went on your head. A line which went up to the surface. An air compressor up there forcing the air down to you. Right. And with that, you could clump around down there and do all sorts of things. And you could stay down for significant period of time. Well, that depends on the depth.
I see.
Yeah. And we'll get to that in a minute. That has to do with the bends and et cetera.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
At shallow depths, let's say 30 feet, you'd stay down a good chunk of time, an hour and a half, something like that. Go down to 60 feet, and that's the time you're down there is way down. And these guys used to work. We're talking about the early 20th century, up until the Second World War. This was how you got down there to do work. They'd work down there for hours at a time. And they would absorb, we'll get to this in a minute, tremendous amounts of nitrogen into the blood. And then, unless they decompressed, they were in serious trouble. But we'll talk about that in a minute. Now, it was only toward the end of the 19th century, in 1870, when a French physician, whose name was Paul Bert, showed how nitrogen went into solution in the blood and came out slowly. Now, they knew about the bends, which was called Caisson's disease at that time, because it happened to people who were working in pressurized chambers down on bridge abutments and things like that. Anyway, the bends were understood empirically, I mean, that this happened and that you had to decompress. And here, in a nutshell, is the problem. When you're breathing air, of course, under pressure, oxygen goes into the blood, obviously, or you couldn't live, and nitrogen goes into the blood. You have a lot more nitrogen in that air than oxygen. And when the pressure is taken off and you have all of this gas in your blood, it's actually tiny, tiny bubbles of gas. When you have all this stuff in your blood, the oxygen is taken out of the blood very quickly because you're breathing it. The nitrogen stays in the blood. It comes out. It'll come out. It'll work its way out, but it works out slowly. And if you come up too fast and take too much pressure off too soon, it's exactly like opening a bottle of shaken up soda or something like that. All of those bubbles come up, and they form big bubbles. And those big bubbles cannot pass through your veins and arteries, and they get trapped. And they typically get trapped in joints because that's where the circulatory system narrows to go through the joints. And they can also get trapped in the brain. And when that happens, you are in very big trouble. The expression, well, the name, the bends, comes from the fact that these bubbles trapped in the joint were so crippling that the people would be bent over, I mean physically bent over, so it became to be known popular as the bend. The only way that you can avoid that happening is to come up very slowly and to stop. And there are now well worked out tables that if you've been down at 60 feet for 60 minutes, you stop at 30 feet for so many minutes, just breathe, continue to respirate, and you're working the nitrogen out, then you stop again at 20 feet, certain number of minutes, you get rid of more, you stop at 10 feet, certain amount of minutes, etc. And if you're fortunate, and most people are, and you stay within those tables, you won't get bent. But it means that if you've been down to, let's say, 160 feet, and you've been down there for a long time, take you 4 or 5 hours to get back to the surface, because you have to go through these decompression stages. So this was finally understood at the beginning of the 20th century by John Haldane, another Englishman, so they could make these tables about decompression stops and how to get rid, what you had to do to get rid of the nitrogen that was compressed, packed into your blood that way. Now, the tables aren't foolproof. My daughter-in-law, my son, a dive instructor, was a dive instructor. My daughter-in-law, diving with him on an oil rig off of New Orleans, and this is a woman who is now a triathlete, et cetera, so in very good
shape.
At that time, she was a smoker, that's true. And she wasn't in the same shape she's in now. But anyway, she got bent. Strictly diving within the tables, all the safety precautions, everything, and she got bent. And she had to go into a recompression chamber, and she suffered no lingering effect. So even the tables aren't foolproof. It's a problem.
Do the tables take into account body weight?
No, they don't. But the original tables, the ones that I dove on when I was a kid, were done by the U.S. Navy. Mm-hmm. There were no sport diving tables at all.
Right.
And they were clearly designed for very fit young men.
Right.
The naval divers.
That's the only one that could go down.
That's right. They were the ones who did it. The sport diving tables are much more conservative because they realize that there are,
There's a bigger range of people.
And there's also tables which tell you, after you've been diving once, how long you have to stay on the surface before you go diving again. Because even though you've come up, according to the tables, you haven't been bent, you still have some residual nitrogen dissolved mm-hmm. in the blood. And ordinary respiratory,
take care of it.
It's called gassing off. You'll get rid of the rest of that bad nitrogen, and then you can go down again.
Are there any symptoms of that at all?
Oh, yeah. There's lots of symptoms.
I mean, not of the bends, but of this gassing off.
No. When the process of gassing off is symptomless, completely painless, etc.
Right.
But of the bends, it can be nausea, sudden pain, vertigo, all sorts of things.
Loss of consciousness, even. Yeah. I mean, and death,
and of course,
obviously.
Yeah. So now we've gone through that aspect of diving, but the dream remained of swimming around down there like a fish, not tethered to the surface with lifelines and voice lines and airlines and all of this kind of stuff that a deep sea diver traditionally had, untethered. And in fact, Leonardo da Vinci in the 1500s sketched a device with, and this is how he described it, a breastplate of armor, sacks of sand for ballast to, keep you down there, and a wineskin to contain the breath. So you needless to say, this was never tried, but you take down a bag of air with you, which would be gone, within about 7 seconds, you would have used it up, or it would have been squashed almost to nothing by the pressure, right. And it was only during the Second World War, and this actually happened while the war was still going on in occupied France, the breakthrough came. And that's when, in the south of France, Jacques Cousteau and an engineer friend of his by the name of Emile Gauguin, they designed, built, and tested a demand valve for monitoring air from compressed air. That's the aqualung or the scuba. Self-contained underwater breathing apparatus was born. The apparatus is actually extraordinarily simple in design. You have compressed air in a cylinder, of course.
Metal cylinder.
Yeah, that's right.
Withstands the pressure.
That's right. And that has the pressure of that air is far greater than the surrounding water pressure. In fact, a modern scuba tank would take pressure up to 3,000 pounds per square inch. So there's a lot of air packed into that tank. Now, the question is, how do you get the air out of that tank, not just by opening the valve and come out at 3,000 pounds per square inch? I mean, it'd blow you away.
Right.
But at exactly the same pressure as the ambient water pressure. And that's what the demand valve is. That's what these guys invented. Wow. So when you take air out of what's called your regulator, what it's doing is giving you air at exactly the same pressure as the water pressure around you. So if you're down, 100 feet, and the water is putting, whatever that would be in pressure on you, I could think of it more easily in atmospheres, then it will give you air at that pressure. So that's what they invented, and that was the big breakthrough. That made scuba possible.
Huh. An interesting thing, because I'm following along here with your notes, too, and that happened during the Second World War. Now, it doesn't describe it as being a military...
No, it
but
wasn't.
But it had military applications,
tremendous
certainly,
military
and
applications.
There was some motivation there. And then I read up above what Da Vinci said, Leonardo Da Vinci said about, I'll let you read it because you're better at that.
Yeah, I skipped that. He said, I'd This is Leonardo. I do not publish or divulge these plans by reason of the evil nature of man who would use these as a means of murder at the bottom of the sea.
Exactly. And then the next paragraph goes into the development of that during World War II. And so he really was a student of the nature of man.
Absolutely. And since that time, there have been all kinds of refinements and inventions, innovations. And now, for instance, you've all seen pictures of it. You breathe in the air from a scuba regulator, and you exhale, and all these bubbles come out because you're dumping the air. There are also devices, and they were devised mainly by the military, which are called rebreathers. So instead of dumping that air out into its closed circuit, you breathe them. Firemen also use them. You breathe it back in, and the carbon dioxide, which is in your exhalation, is scrubbed. More oxygen is added, and so you keep rebreathing. Now, these are very dangerous devices, because if they fail, you're really in trouble. There's all sorts of problems. But nevertheless, I've never used one, although I've watched them used. They enable the military uses are clear, because you can sneak up on things without leaving a trail of bubbles. But they're also used in scientific research because you can go up to a creature and instead of making all these noisy bubbles, it's very silent. So you can get much closer to a creature. And there's also mixed gas we've talked about. They take the nitrogen out of the air and they replace it with inert gases, helium sometimes and other gases like that, so that you can stay down longer because there's not as much nitrogen in the mix, so you don't absorb as much nitrogen, so you don't have as much nitrogen to gas off. But they needn't concern us here, but it's not surprising that they continue to innovate with these self-contained. A few words about submarines, because that's the third way to get down there that we've talked about. Now, as you mentioned earlier with the scuba, war has been a tremendous stimulant for the development of subs. The first one that comes on sort of the American screen is in the Revolutionary War. And there was something done by a man named Bushnell, and it was called Bushnell's Turtle. And I think I have a picture of Mr. Turtle here. Yeah, the turtle. The turtle had two propellers on it. It was basically a enclosed, like an egg, not too much bigger than a man. And if you turned one crank, it turned a propeller and made you go forward. You turned another crank, pointed in the other, it made you go up. It had a little rudder, and the idea was to use this thing to bore a hole in a British warship and make it sink. It did not work, but they tried, right?
I imagine a few lives were lost in the trial of this.
Right. The French in 1887 had a battery-powered sub, two men, which carried a torpedo. Now, it wasn't a torpedo as we know them now that come out of a torpedo tube, etc. It was basically a buoyant bomb. So it was carried outside the submarine. You released it, and since it wanted to go to the surface, if you released it below the enemy vessel, it would go up to the bottom of the vessel and blow a hole in it. As far as I know, that one never really worked either. But the submarine certainly stayed on in fantasy. I mean, we have Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea with his Nautilus and the people coming out of it and all of this. So the submarine was very much, on the, what can we call it, in the consciousness of popular culture. But it was the Second World War. The First World War, which really brought the submarine.
Yeah.
Onto the front page. And it was an unbelievably lethal weapon because they had very few defenses against it. They didn't have sonar at that time. They didn't have any way to detect the thing.
Right.
So They did their damage, and the compressed air torpedo had been invented. The First World War submarine wasn't dramatically different from the early Second World War submarines, and they had almost no defenses against it except once it had attacked, to attack it with depth charges, but not any defense against it which would stop it in advance. And then, of course, we all know in the Second World War what the U-boats did, the German U-boats did. They almost cut the lifeline between the United States and Europe until some countermeasures were invented, including good sonar and stuff like that. But they took a tremendous, tremendous toll, as did Japanese submarines in the Pacific, as did American submarines in the Pacific as well. And then, of course, in the post-war period, they became with nuclear submarines, which solved the fuel problem. The fuel problem being that submarines on the surface, the traditional submarine, if you will, World War I, World War II, ran on diesel power. And on the surface, they make 17, 18 knots, something like that. When they submerged, they ran on electric power. You can't run a diesel down there. They ran on electric power. And so they had massive banks of batteries in them. And those batteries could only be recharged on the surface. So they had to surface to air out the sub and to recharge the batteries. So there was a tremendous fuel problem. Excuse me. They had to carry enough fuel, of course, to do that. With a nuclear submarine, it ran on the surface on nuclear power, and it ran under the surface on nuclear power. And there wasn't really a fuel problem. They could carry plenty of fuel for their missions. And, of course, they could also be armed with nuclear weapons. So, as far as I know, you know, those things, that I think are still, some of them are still out there.
Yeah.
Where they're pointing them, I don't know.
Yeah, but, exactly.
Yeah, but they're still out there. Now, the other aspect of the submarine story is the research submersible. And it was a research submersible that I went down in, belonged to the Harbor Branch Oceanographic Foundation. And it was basically, you know, there's, it was small. It was designed to go to up to 3,000 feet. And, you know, in movies like the Titanic and others, you've seen pictures of these and on Discovery Channel documentaries. Typically, they have a big acrylic bubble of some kind in front where the pilot and observer sits. Seldom carry more than four people. This particular one had an acrylic bubble, the one I went on to. It had an aft chamber, excuse me, which was not an acrylic bubble, but was a four-inch thick steel cylinder to withstand the pressure, and with tremendously thick, small windows, which were difficult to see out of. They were really like porthole. You had to press your nose against them to look out. But it was still really quite thrilling because at those depths there's no ambient light. And when they flick on the submarine's light, then you see all of these incredible creatures that are on these bioluminescent things. Sometimes even with the lights out, a bioluminescent jellyfish would come wandering back. I mean, it's like outer space.
Yeah,
it was really wonderful. So anyway, these kinds of submersibles, small submersibles, you know, a big nuclear sub is hundreds of feet long. These things are 20, 25, 30 feet long. They became key tools for oceanographic and marine research. And, you know, typical of us as a species, or at least the scientific culture adventure part, once they got good submersibles, the question was, can we go to the deepest place in the ocean? Because, of course, they wanted to see what the deepest place in the ocean was. The deepest place in the ocean is called the Mariana Trench. It's off the Philippines. It's in the Pacific. And it goes to 35,800 feet. So you're approaching, you're just about at 7 miles down at that point. And, of course, that's farther down than Everest is up. Everest is just shy of 30,000. So it's way down there. The Mariana Trench. And you cannot go down there in one of these what I would call conventional research submarines. They'd be crushed by the pressure down there. These, as far as I know, the deepest of these dive to about 6,000 feet, and you still have another 30,000 feet to go.
That's a big gap there.
That's a big gap there. So something was invented called the bathyscape. I'm not sure why it was called the bathyscape. It was named Trieste. And here's how the thing worked. There was a gigantic gasoline-filled balloon. Now, liquids, almost all liquids, are non-compressible at depth. You can just not squeeze any molecular or atomic space out of them. You might get half of 1% or 1%. But basically what that means, that if you fill this huge balloon at the surface with gasoline, that when it gets down to that deep, it will be the same size it was before. So you're not losing any of the buoyancy from it, okay? And gasoline is lighter than water, right? So this huge gasoline-filled balloon has positive buoyancy. If you hang from that a little sphere, because the sphere is the shape that best withstands pressure, because the pressure is absolutely equal all around it on every square inch. So if you take a sphere that is, let's say, 8-10 inches thick of solid steel, it can go down to those depths because it won't be crushed. If it were irregular, it would be crushed, but not as a sphere. You can even, an egg's not a sphere, but on our little research submarine, they take eggs down to 2,000 feet, and they wouldn't be crushed because they're full of liquid and, you know, the stress on them, the right. weight was...
Such a fragile shell, too.
Right. Anyway, so this huge gasoline bag with this little cylinder hung from it was taken down. I have a picture, and I'm trying to see whether this picture shows... Yeah. This little steel sphere that was hung from it was 7'2" across on the outside. So you could just get two people in there with a little air supply, a little oxygen supply for them to breathe. And you could let this thing sink down and then with ballast on it. Then when you're at the bottom, you release and you've looked out the tiny little ports in it, you release the balance, and the beast will rise back to the surface again. It's not mechanically taken down there. It's just a question of... So if anything goes wrong, of course, you know, if the gasoline bag gets punctured or starts to leak, you know, you're going to spend your last 2 days at the bottom. Anyway, they got all the way down. And there's been... I don't know if there have been any other attempts to go back down there. It doesn't seem to have much scientific yield to it, but it was something which, given our propensity to go higher, deeper, et cetera, et cetera.
But they had no visual at all.
I'm sorry?
They had no visual at all.
They did have visual through tiny ports and a couple of little lights. And it's a dead world. It's a dead world.
There's nothing there.
There's nothing there, yeah. Much of the interesting stuff subsequently with the submersible has been found at much shallower depths. By shallower depths, I mean 1,500, 2,000, stuff like that, easily within reach of modern research submersibles. They found volcanic vents at the bottom of the sea pouring out hot sulfurous gases and molten lava and all sorts of unbelievably wonderful stuff. So let's hold it here because I want to talk next time then about what I call a wish to be a fish. Because we've talked a lot about technology and the physiology of all of this and devices to get us down there. But given the adventure and the competition has largely taken place in free diving. Because not surprisingly, given the kind of species we are and the kind of culture we have, a tremendous competition has been set up to see who can hold their breath the longest and go the deepest. So I want to talk about that next time, because this is where it really gets astounding.
Oh, I'm looking forward to that. And this has been a pre-recorded program of This Strange and Wonderful World. And we're spending the month of June, anyway, in warm waters, some of them very deep. And tune in 2 weeks to the next program on This Strange and Wonderful World. This has been pre-recorded on KLOI-LP, Lopez Island, Washington, 102.9 FM. And good afternoon to you, Richard. And
good afternoon to you, Carol.
And good afternoon to all our listeners today. Thank you so much for tuning in. And enjoy the music.